and welcome to Phoenix Cinema Podcast. I'm Chris Austin.
And I'm Luke Parker.
And joining us today is a special guest. And this guest is an Emmy-nominated screenwriter and director who has written films such as the rom-com teen classic Just Friends and the film Gardener of Eden, as well as the head writer and producer of the documentary series Brain Games, which can be found on Disney+, and the creator of the educational series Brainchild, which you can find on Netflix. And that guest's name is Adam Tex Davis. Adam, welcome.
Hey, good to be here. Nice to meet you guys.
And you. We were meant to have this chat last weekend, and we had to reschedule, but it's funny because I'd written some notes, as I always do, just questions and jumping off points to use for the episode. And in trying to copy and paste those notes on my Mac, I ended up deleting them all.
Oh.
And I couldn't get it back. So probably for the best that the call didn't go ahead as planned, as maybe my thoughts wouldn't be quite coherent. But we're here now. Notes are in place and we're good to go.
Excellent.
So yeah, thank you for joining us.
You got it. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to talk movies with true movie fans.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump right in. And I know Luke, you have some questions for Adam as well. But yeah. I guess I'll start with just by asking how did filmmaking come about for you? Was it something that you stumbled into? Was it something you always wanted to be a part of?
I can't say it was something I always wanted to be a part of. I always enjoyed telling stories. And I always enjoyed writing. And I remember my agent at one point early on in my career, he was like, "You're one of those few writers who actually enjoys writing," which I thought was such a weird thing to say. But now that I'm older, I get it, because it can be a pain in the ass, you know. Right, these days, I actually enjoy rewriting more than I enjoy writing. So it's like I'm always looking for like some young, hungry me, you know, from 20 years ago, who's going to write the first draft, and then I can come and rewrite it and make it better. But the point is, I mean, look, and they say, like, you know, writing is rewriting. So whether it's me doing the first draft or somebody else, it's still a ton of rewriting. But I always loved writing. For a second, I thought I was going to be a Stephen King horror novelist. Then I got into journalism. I was an editor on my school paper. But I had this nasty habit that if the story wasn't good enough, I would embellish it. I would quote myself as an unnamed source. I would add things to make the story better. And I was like, who cares? It's a high school paper. Like, you know. But then a story I wrote actually got like second place in the nation. And I had to go to like Columbia University to pick up this like silver medal. And the story was like, I don't know, 70% bullshit. And I was like, oh boy. So I had enough journalistic integrity to know that I had no journalistic integrity. And so I was like, you know what? What's a way I can like do that, like where I take a kernel of truth like journalism, but then embellish the hell out of it and make it fun? And I was like, oh, movies. You know, I always loved movies as a kid. And I was like, okay, what if I, you know, took that and you know, and turned that into more of a, you know, screenplays instead of, you know, instead of stories or instead of journalistic articles. And yeah, I got into NYU film school and I just loved it. I did everything you could think of on the film. I wanted to learn lighting. I was the dolly grip. I did everything. And I directed a movie as well. And it did well enough for me that people out in LA saw it. And they said, hey, this is great. What else do you have? And this is the big thing. Like, and I tell everybody that's like wants to get into the business, you have to just do it. If you're going to be a writer, you have to write. So they asked my, you know, this manager saw it and they said, love the movie. What else do you have? And I said, I've written four scripts. And he said, great, send me your best two. So I sent the two that I thought were the best. And he said, yeah, these have a great voice, really fun humor. I don't know if we can sell either of these, but they'll be a great calling card. It'll get you meetings. And then we can work on figuring out what's the big high concept thing that you can write. And that's how it all started for me. And it wasn't that long after I got out of school. It still took a couple of years to finish my film. But That was the entryway. And if I had said to him, like, oh, I've got a couple of ideas or I'm thinking about, like, nothing would have happened. But I, on my own, I'm working in a bagel store. I'm working in a factory. But I'm writing at night. And I had these four scripts. And so, yeah, that's kind of how, yeah, that was kind of my origin story.
Thank you for saying that, actually, as well, Adam. I think that's such an important lesson for any aspiring screenwriter or director, is keep producing the work. Yes, I mean, if you had said, yeah, I don't have anything but ideas, I mean, and that is the situation that so many people find themselves in. I mean, I'm a writer, and once you've done one script, you go, cool, well, I love that. Let's focus on that. and then years go by and you get caught up in work life and commitments. And then you think, what have I got to show if anyone comes knocking?
Right.
So that's a great lesson.
Yeah. And then, you know, it was funny because the other thing is, like, you know, the stuff of mine that has sold for the most part has been kernels of truth that I then embellish, my version of bad journalism. So like Just Friends, you know, was the hell of being in the friend zone for 2 years in college. and then I wrote that, you know, I wrote a first draft and my manager was like, is this about me? And I was like, wait, what? Why? How or why would I write about you? Well, that was like a light bulb went off. And I was like, oh.
Universal.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. And the executive said the same thing. And then this one and that one. Same thing with the very first script that I ever sold, which was right before Just Friends, which never got made. But I did sell. I had wound up on spring break with my parents. It was, you know, I had just graduated college. My parents had a timeshare in Cancun, Mexico. They wanted to go. They wanted me to come, and my girlfriend and my brother and his girlfriend, and nobody else could make it except me. I had no excuse. And so I was like, ah, screw it. I'll go. I'll just hang out and drink and wander around Mexico. It'll be fun. And I show up and there's a big banner, welcome spring breakers. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm on spring break. Spring break with my parents. But then I was like, you know, I bought a notebook and I just tried to manufacture as much zaniness as possible. Brought my mom to Senor Frogs and got her in a foam party. I got my father, you know, he was in the hot tub smoking weed with the frat boys and stuff. And it was just great. And I wrote down every stupid thing that happened and I turned it into a script. And managed to sell it to Harvey Weinstein when he was at Miramax. And so that was my first script sale.
That's big.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that we went out with it to everybody and nobody bought it. And so I was feeling kind of shitty. And I was like, huh, when else have I felt shitty like this? Oh, I know, when I was in the friend zone for 2 years with that girl. And so I started the friend before the other one had even sold. And just, again, you got to do it if you're going to be a writer. Just like, you know, are you a filmmaker or a films maker? You know, like put an F on it. You know, am I a screenwriter? Yes. That means I'm going to write multiple things. So I started Just Friends. And then sure enough, just as I was finishing up Just Friends, I get the call. Like, are you sitting down? Because Harvey Weinstein read your script on a plane and he was laughing his ass off and he wants to meet you. And, you know, I mean, I wish I had a better hero to help me get my career started.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. During the meeting with him, at one point, he said, you know, your script is about a kid who goes on spring break with his parents, but kids hate their parents. So let's fucking lose the parents. And I was like, but wait, it's a script about a kid on spring break with his parents. If we lose the parents, it's just a kid goes on spring break. And he's like, yeah, but I got some other ideas. And we talked. And then I said, look, we got to keep the parents somewhere in there. All right, fine. We'll make it a C story. He goes, but it's not believable. I go, but it
happened.
It happened. And this is great because he goes, I go, it happened. It happened to me. And he goes, huh. Oh, well, I guess I've lived a better life than you. So that's what he said at our first meeting. But you know what? Now I'll pick my life over his. So fuck.
Absolutely.
Fuck
now, who's got the last laugh?
Yeah, fuck you, Harvey. But seriously, yeah. But that never wound up getting made. It came very close, and then whatever, for whatever reason, you know, it never got made. And then yeah, but Just Friends was my next sale, and that did get made. And then in the interim, I also got hired to write a spring break movie for MTV, like the channel. Had read my spring break movie, said, we love it, but it's R-rated. We can't do that, but we have another idea for a spring break movie. And they hired me to write that. So,
is that Spring Break Lawyer?
Yes, it sure is. You did your homework. You did your homework.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I thought Spring Break, I hadn't seen it, but I thought maybe that was what you were referring to with the parents. But oh, okay. So jumping off of that.
Wait, you haven't seen Spring Break Lawyer? That work of rare genius? What? Like the rest of the world. I'll tell you what. Look, you know what? It was a great first thing. It was a great first project. It was a great experience. I mean, literally, I was working in a factory in Hackensack, New Jersey that made car washes. Like all the machinery that you would find in a car wash, I was helping make the drilling and cutting and getting hurt every day, and it was like torture. But I could make a lot of money to pay off my student film and then go home at night and write. And the thing is, I get a call and it's like, we love your Spring Break script, but there's nothing we can do with that. But we have our own idea. And she goes, I'm going to say three words. My pitch is three words: Spring Break Lawyer. And I'm just like, I've got three words. I'm out of here. And I get up and I pretend I'm going to leave. And then I sit back down. I'm like, look, I work in a car wash factory. I've got $300 in the bank. I'm paying off my film. Like, let's do it. I don't care.
I'll take it.
And I go, what is the idea? And she's like, well, we have the rights of this guy. He's a 45-year-old lawyer who goes on spring break and helps the kids get out of trouble. And I was just like, what? I was like, well, you're MTV. Nobody wants to see a 45-year-old dude like that's a lawyer. I go, I would make it like a kid's like a law student who gets kicked out of school because he cheats, but he goes on spring break because he already bought his ticket. And while he's there, he gets in trouble, but he uses the tiny bit of legalese he's picked up from school to get out of trouble. Somebody sees it, says, hey, can you help me? He helps them. And then suddenly everybody's coming to him and he starts a cottage business in a bar. And everybody, now he's the spring break lawyer. And she goes, yeah, okay, you're hired. So that was how that went down, and it got, you know, got made right away. And it was great. And I got to work with the director and he had me on set, and yeah, it was, I learned a lot.
It's incredible, because how do you, and I'm assuming this is early on for you. You must have been fairly young when this was all happening, right?
Yeah, like late 20s, I'd say, like 28, 29, maybe.
How do you manage your own ego in that sense, because surely you must have felt like anything you touch is kind of gold. I mean, even going back to the journalism and coming second place and all these things are kicking off for you and meetings with Harvey Weinstein, you must have thought, I'm fucking good.
You know what? Here's the thing. You have to have an unshakable belief in yourself, but you know that, like, there's always people doing way better than you. Right. So it's like, you know, just, you know, and look, here's the thing. I'm never afraid to do the work, you know, and I found that, like, fortunately, you know, if I did the work and I put the time in and I worked on stuff, you know, usually had a decent outcome, not always the best. Mm. Again, you know, I mean, the script was called Sunburned that Harvey Weinstein bought. But the thing is, it went out to the town, and I thought for sure it was going to sell. It was a teen sex comedy, kid on spring break, trying to get laid. His parents are there. His brother's getting laid all the time, his younger brother. And, like, he can't get the girl he loves and blah, blah, blah. And it was super fun and super funny, and nobody bought it. Mm. They were like, we're not doing teen sex comedies or whatever. And then American Pie came out, and I was like, oh, maybe there's a shot, you know. But yeah, and then suddenly it's like, oh, it's just another teen sex comedy that everybody's writing them now. So it's like, you know, there's waves of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've had good outcomes. You know, I never had an ego because, or, you know, I had a belief that I could do it. That was the most important thing. But I will say this, like, the first time I ever went to my manager's office out in L.A., like, they flew me in because to take some meetings, try to get an agent and stuff. And when I got to the office and I see all these assistants sitting at desks and there are piles of scripts next to them. And then there's a bookshelf in the hallway with more scripts. And then each manager has their own bookshelf with scripts that have now made it into the office and are on the magical manager bookshelf. And then I'm looking at the titles of them, and none of them have ever gotten made. And it's just like, there's so many. And this is just one management office of hundreds in the city, and there's agents. And I'm like, if I had saw all of that first, it might have been too daunting.
Right,
like,
right.
I'm just going to add my script to a stack of shit. And no one's up, you know?
Yeah,
I was just like, you know, I felt like I had a good voice, and you know, I could make things funny, and you know, and look, my manager was infinitely helpful. Chris Bender was infinitely helpful in helping me become a better writer. And, you know, that was the thing. I'm not afraid to learn. I certainly don't think I know everything. I feel like I'm still learning today. But put in the work, put in the time, and you have to have some belief in yourself, because you're going to hear no a lot. And if you're the kind of person that hears no and says, okay, and walks away, then it's not for you, and it's done. I mean, look, I was decent in the car wash factory, but I'm not good at most things. But I feel like writing was the thing I was meant to do. So,
yeah, definitely sounds like an industry where thick skin comes in handy.
It's the first thing you got to do: grow yeah. Rhinoceros like skin. Yeah,
I am such a great lesson.
Yeah, I know you're probably a bit fed up of talking about this, but I just wanted to ask about just friends and kind of. How involved were you in like the production of that film, and what was the production process like?
So the I gotta say, I was very fortunate. I was pretty involved with a lot of the stuff. We had slipped early drafts to an executive over at New Line, and he loved the concept of it and had even given some thought. But of course, was also like, is this about me? And it's like, no, it's not about you. But again, great sign that everybody thinks, you know, it is a universal thing. And then, when it got like up to the, you know, are they going to buy it? Yeah, they're going to buy it. They did a preemptive, you know, bid on it. And I had the opportunity to like go out to the rest of the town or to accept this first look offer. And, you know, we talked about it, and it was a nice chunk of change. Certainly was going to change my life. And I was like, you know, and they said, look, here's the thing, though. If we go out to the town, you might be able to leverage it and get some more. Or if everybody says no, then their offer goes down because they know they're the only game in town.
So that's tricky.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. And so we said no. It was like, no, let's take this. And then it was like they involved me in some casting. Who do you think, or this one or that one? They would show me people. They said, hey, there's this new guy on SNL that the ladies seem to like a lot. We think he's going to break through. This guy named Jimmy Fallon. What do you think of him? I wound up on a day date with Jimmy Fallon. We spent the whole day together in New York. He wasn't even famous enough that we could walk through Times Square and he didn't get accosted. You know, we went record shopping. We got hamburgers. You know, it's like nobody bothered us. And
is this for the lead role?
Yeah, this was for the lead. And then they talked about this one and that one. There was different combinations. What if it's Adam Sandler and Julia Roberts? Or what if it's Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore? What if it's this one or that one? And then, a friend told me about Ryan Reynolds, and I checked out some stuff, and I was like, he's good. And I kind of threw his name out there, and they say, oh, no, we're actually looking at him. I definitely mentioned Anna Faris because I thought she was, like, fearless in the scary movies, and they liked her. a buddy of mine who's a director saw the movie A Girl Next Door, or The Girl Next – is it or The? The Girl Next Door with Elisa Cuthbert. But said, look, I think I just saw the younger brother. This guy, Chris Marquette, was in the movie, and he was great. And so I suggested him to the casting. And then, the director, you know, he and I bonded. He came to New York, and we worked for 2 weeks, you know, shaping the script even more. And he said, I like working with you, so I want you on set. So I got to be on set the whole time.
Lovely.
Dreamy.
You know, also it was like, hey, what scene are you going to be in? I'm like, oh, I get to be in the movie? They're like, yeah, of course. So I was like, okay. I go, I could play this part. If you've seen Just Friends, there's a scene where Anna Faris is at the heavy metal club, and I'm the guy that throws a beer can and hits her in the face, and then she jumps off the stage and beats me up.
Excellent.
So that was super fun. But yeah, I got to be there, helping, you know, if there was rewrites or just ad-libbing or whatever, I could throw stuff out there. And the director, you know, it was one of those things where you realize, like, the director is kind of getting attacked by everybody. You know, everybody has thoughts. Everybody has ideas. The producers, the money people, guy who, like, introduced producer A to producer B and brought in, yeah. Some money. Like, he comes on set and he's got ideas. What if this happened? And the director's got to field all this. And also, you know, the studio and everybody's like, so it's like the director needs an ally. What better ally to have than the writer? And especially someone like me, who's like young and hungry and excited and getting my movie made after like 5 years of development and stuff. And who knew I'd ever, you know, wind up on set. And I'm like, you know, I became the director's ally. So he would run. He's like, you're the only one whose comedy sense I trust. Like, do you think this is funny? Do you think this is working or whatever? And I was like, I love this. You know, this is great, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this is good, but maybe, blah, blah, you know, and we would talk through stuff. And like he even said
that. And that's amazing too, because right? That's uncommon, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, super uncommon. I mean, I you know, look, again, I made it my... You know, the movies that have mine that have gotten made, I made it my mission to befriend and become an ally and a resource for the director, so they would want me on set. And
right.
You know, I'm not trying to get in the way and like fight over stuff. I'm here to like, let's make everything we can as good as possible. And you know, I mean, look, you know, even on Spring Break Lawyer, the director was like, he's like, look, I'm going to give you carte blanche. Any ideas you have, any jokes you want to add, just come to me. He goes, the only thing I beg of you is do not talk to the actors directly. If you want to give a note, come to me, and then I can give the note to the actors. And I was like, absolutely, absolutely.
You are not Oliver Stone on Scarface. Please don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll tell you what, these fucking actors, man, they will fuck you. There were these group of actors playing like the friends of the kid who gets in trouble or whatever. And they would come up to me after every take and they would be like, what'd you think, Tex? What'd you think, Tex? You're the writer. You wrote this. Is this how you envisioned it? And I would be like, just keep doing what you're doing. Listen to the director. Don't worry about me. And they kept cornering me. And then one day they cornered me at lunch and I was tired. And they said, what did you think of that last scene? And I was like, it was great. It was great. And they're like, no, come on. I could see it in your face. You're not happy. You're not happy. And I was like, okay, look, between you and me, I think you guys are playing it a little too big. In my head, it was meant to underplay it. But I'll tell you what, just do what the director says. This conversation never happened. I will talk to the director after lunch and we'll get one take or two where it's a little more subtle. I'm sure he'll do them that favor and don't worry about it. But this conversation never happened. And the actors go back, we come out of lunch, first take, they do it super subtle. And then the director goes, hey, what happened? What happened to the big thing? And they go, Tex told us to do it like this.
Oh, mother.
Yeah. And I'm over by the video village, and the director's in the other room, and I know I see him on camera, like, coming, and I just throw myself down on my knees, and I'm like, begging. I'm like, Alan, I swear to God, I'm gonna fucking kill these two, but I swear to God, I did not help
them. They cornered me.
Yeah. Motherfucker. Yeah, anyway. So that's another rule. Like, yeah, the actors will screw you.
It's incredible. And the fact that you got to, you know, you developed these incredible close relationships with your directors. And does that mean that, for instance, with something like Spring Break Lawyer and Just Friends, the final product, the final film that ended up on screen, does that hew as close to the screenplay as you initially envisioned it then?
Never.
Right,
you know, I mean,
right.
It's always going to be a collaborative, a little bit of me, a little bit of them, a little bit of the actors, a little bit. Yeah, there's always going to be something. I mean, I'll tell you a story. I mean, there was a scene in Just Friends, like basically there was a whole bit that was scripted that we couldn't shoot it the way it was scripted. Not for nothing other than there was an incident or a thing with an actor and the schedule changed and they had to get this actor out of the movie. And I don't want to name any names, but the point is the studio was just like, get him out of the movie earlier during this scene. So now we have to make a new scene. And as I was trying to figure it out, the director and the actors went and spitballed and came up with something and they kind of presented it to me. And I was just like, I don't love that. Can I have some time to figure it out? And the director's like, A, there's really not that much time. And B, these guys are happy. They want to do this. So if I say no, I might have a little actor mutiny on my hands.
Sure.
So then I was like, okay, but let me go write something right now. And then you guys can do the one that you have. And then maybe I'll come in and we'll just change it a little bit. How about that? And he's like, yeah, sure. Go out and do that. And of course, I go out, I write something, and
they shoot the thing.
They shot their thing, and then they fucking locked the door, and they didn't let me back in. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I'm trying to get back in, and there's a PA blocking the door, and he's like, dude, I can't let you in. The director told me not to let you back in. And I was like, dude, if you don't let me in, I'm going to tell everybody that you smoke weed, because... last night we were smoking weed, but but I was like, God damn it. So then I went and I just ate all the craft service. I was like, fuck you guys. I ate everything. So if you guys want to snap it, fuck you.
I've eaten all the donuts. They're gone.
Yeah. Sorry. You changed the scene.
That's
I ate the donut.
Funny.
Yeah. I mean, look, I make light of it, but shit happens and not everything's in your control. I mean, it is funny too, the way people will, like reviewers or critics or whatever, you know, I'll get slammed for a line that was ad-libbed by an actor. I'll get credit for a line that was ad-libbed by an actor, you know? So it's like, it's always going to change. And, you know, you have a genius like Anna Faris on set. She's going to come up with stuff. The director comes up with stuff. So yeah, it's always going to be a little different. But I'm just like, in my mind, I'm like, we're all here because I decided to write something.
So, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And it's so funny because Just Friends is considered a classic. It does feel like a classic. When I rewatched the film, all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, I'm remembering all of this from my teen years. I was like, yes, it's all coming back to me. I've seen this before. And it's a film full of young stars, extremely hot at the time. And in a way, for a teen comedy in 2005 to have Ryan Reynolds, Anna Faris, Amy Smart, Chris Klein, it's a dream team.
Yeah.
And speaking about what the actors bring to the roles, so there is an amazingly hysterical scene in the movie where Reynolds' character goes on a date with Amy Smart's character, his childhood crush, and it doesn't go as well or as smoothly as he'd hoped. And he drops her off at her door, walks back to his car, and once he's inside, he freaks out and just has this mini meltdown. Mid-meltdown, he doesn't realize she's walked back to his car and is just staring at him through the window. It's a very funny scene, and it's a tremendous piece of physical comedy from Reynolds.
Stupid! 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 What the hell? Don't! God! Oh my God! It's his elbow! It's a simple. I don't think there was one, but if there was one, I bet it would be in the south.
I left my gloves in the car.
Oh. And I'm so curious. How do you write a scene like that? Is that something that you write in as much detail as possible? Was it even written in the first place, or was that something that Reynolds brought to things?
So one of the things that we talked about, Roger Cumble, the director, and I, was, you know, he was like, look, Ryan Reynolds has a Jim Carrey-like ability to just be really funny and do crazy stuff beyond the script. So in a lot of instances, let's try to make time to do a Ryan take. Just like, here, get the script, and then we do one for Ryan and tell him to go nuts, you know? So that scene was scripted, but the one that's in the film, I think, is the Ryan take where it's like, go nuts. Like, he did the stuff, you know, the way it was scripted, which was talking to himself, I can't believe I'm going to, you know, the body. And he does the whole thing, and then it's like, okay, now that's our baseline. Let's crank it up more. Go nuts. And he's like, okay. And he starts doing the thing where the hands are talking to each other like finger puppets. Yeah. And she laughs for real. Like, she literally breaks for a second. But it's so cute and endearing. It feels real. It feels like a real reaction. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, we like cut. Everybody starts laughing. And he's like, oh my God, that was ridiculous. You cannot use that one. And it's like, no, we're probably going to use that one. Like, that was gold. Like, we're done here. And yeah. So it's like, yeah, when you have an actor of that ability, give them a take or two, let them do what they do and see what you get. And, you know, even if you don't use all of it, some of it will be, you know, it will be good. And Anna Faris was the same way, where you could just, she has a, you know, there's a scene in the bar where she's sitting there waiting while he first sees Amy Smart, and they're talking, and she's like, Chris, and he's like, I'm busy. And then she's like, I'm busy. And then, you know, but like, and then I think she added stupid dick because I think the director yelled out, say stupid dick. And so she said it's stupid. Right. But we were just throwing lines at her, and she was just delivering the line back, and every one of them was hilarious. We could have done one of 17 different lines for that.
God, that's awesome. Great. I mean, that's great.
Yeah. When you have talented people, like, that's what you can do. You assemble a I mean, Chris Klein, to me, has never been better. I know, you know.
100% agree with that. 100% agree. His exit from the movie is one of the best exits of a character I've ever seen.
Yeah, so that was part of the scene that they came up with. And I did like that, although I don't love a guy... Like, I have a pet peeve about people that are playing things masterfully and then slip up and say something stupid and then their whole plot is unraveled. Like, this guy is too smooth for that. So the real ending was, like, when Ryan Reynolds goes back to Los Angeles, he's supposed to think they're together. Amy Smart and Chris Klein's characters are together. And then he goes back and then he decides to come back to New Jersey and give Chris Klein a record deal. Not so much even because he thinks he's the greatest talent. He has enough talent, but also to take care of her. And then he's like, oh, he's moved on. Oh, we're just friends, whatever. And he's like, woohoo, I got a record deal. He grabs another random girl at the bar and starts making out with her. And then Ryan Reynolds realizes that the Amy Smart character is free and available. So then he goes and he does the heartfelt speech and stuff. So that was kind of the original end. And then they were like, we can't do all that and whatever. So it's like, we got to get Chris Klein out. But I do think that that part was great. Like, he was great when he threatens to punch a guy and his exit is great. Yeah. But I do hate, I don't love, as a writer, I don't love how we got to that, because he says, like, you know, he slips up and says something stupid. And she's like, oh no, we're just friends. And it's like, I was like, oh, okay. It's so basic. It's right. So too easy.
It was too easy. Yeah.
So I was trying to write around that. Like, how do I figure that out? Yeah.
Like, right.
Anyway, whatever. It is what it is. Some people love it. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I actually watched it for the first time ever a few days ago. Well, just before our when we scheduled our first call, and I thought it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
I appreciate that. I mean, we definitely tried to make it funny. You know, it's like a romantic comedy, but we really wanted to stress the comedy. You know, glad you liked it.
So I'm going to move away maybe from your career just a bit, and I want to talk more maybe about your relationship with film. Like you mentioned, growing up, you love movies and. Maybe I just want to know more, what were those films that like you were enamored by growing up, and maybe some of your influences? Like, I mean, I'm looking behind you right now and I can see some absolute goldies behind you.
Yeah.
Clockwork Orange, Jaws. I think that's Harry Callahan.
Yes. Dirty Harry, Clockwork Orange. Jaws was the movie that made me want to make movies.
Makes sense.
It's like a perfect movie. And here's the thing. You go into it thinking it's a shark movie. You know, it's monsters. I've seen monsters. And then it's like, wait, this is not just a monster movie. This is great characters and great everything and whatever. And then I read the book afterwards, and then I loved how he changed things from the book to the movie, you know? Although it is funny, because like in the movie, Richard Dreyfuss's character dies. I mean, in the book, Richard Dreyfuss dies, Hooper dies, and the shark lives. But in the movie, they live, Quint dies, shark dies.
So, shit, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's like, it's kind of cool. Like, oh, wow, you could take the book and even change it and whatever. And then you hear the stories about how Spielberg, the shark didn't work, the mechanical shark didn't work, all that. And so he had to figure out new ways to film it. So that was a big one for me.
With Jaws, like, I used to watch Jaws a lot growing up, and the scene of the head coming out the boat underwater, that I think that scarred me a bit growing up, but I agree, Jaws is an almost perfect film.
Did you ever see, Adam, and you as well, Luke, actually, I don't know if you ever did you ever see the play The Shark Is Broken, or hear about it?
I did hear about it. I intended to go, and then the night we were going to go, I couldn't do it, and I never got to see it, and I'm so bummed. I'm so bummed that I missed it.
Yeah, super cool. Yeah. Super cool. I mean, I saw it here in London on the West End, and I think it stars, is it Robert Shaw's son or something? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just a great, you know, it just gives you so much more insight behind the scenes of when they had so much downtime because the fucking shark wouldn't work.
Right.
You know, and it's, and the way Spielberg works around it is incredible.
Yeah. I remember being a kid and haggling with my parents if I got, or my mom, who was the stickler on the bedtime, like haggling with her. If I got a good enough grade on my test, could I stay up till beyond midnight to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind? all those Spielberg movies were so influential to me. Raiders of the Lost Ark. I will say this, like an early, like where I knew I had the writing bug. Like I went to see Star Wars like all the kids did. But when I got home, I was compelled to take a notebook and write the entire story from memory as best I could of what happens in Star Wars. And like my friends are like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm writing Star Wars. And they're like, it's already written. I'm like, no, I know, but I'm just for myself, I'm just writing it out because I just want to see it as words on the page or something. And, you know, then I got into comedy, of course, and like Airplane and Monty Python movies were hugely influential. The Coen brothers, I remember going into film school thinking that Raising Arizona was the greatest movie ever. And like the way you could be really broad and goofy, but also very real and real seeming, and just a clever use of comedy and camera tricks and camera movement. That was very influential. You know, I love Fight Club. I love Taxi Driver. So I have Dark Stuff, big horror fan. So, you know, although horror is one of those things where, like, the bad ones are so bad and the good ones are really good. And, like, there's such disparity in the horror genre. You know, it's probably the most disparity of anything. Maybe action, yeah, you know.
I totally agree with that. You know, it's so hard to find a good one, but the good ones are always a great time. Yeah.
So I'm actually currently going through the Video Nasties list. I have the there was a list of, I think it was originally 72, and then they blew it up to 154 movies that had, for some reason or another, been banned in countries, especially your country, was really big on banning some of these horror movies that had no nutritional value. It was literally these crazy Italian horror movies and people just getting stabbed in the head and knife come out their mouth and, like, you know, just horrible, horrible movies. A lot of cannibal stuff, zombie holocausts and whatever. And so I have the list and I started, you know, which ones have I seen? And I was like, oh, I'm gonna finish the list. I'm gonna see all of them. I want to see every single one of these banned horror movie lists.
I love that. Yeah, I want to get to that maybe soon, because I know you like to go through lists.
Yes,
you mentioned in your emails. I definitely want to ask you about some of those. And then moving on as well from just friends, you wrote the film Gardener of Eden, which is a film full of great character actors. How does that movie get into the hands of Leonardo DiCaprio? And what was the process like to have him be one of the main producers of the movie?
So that was an interesting one because, again, after I had sold Just Friends, you know, you get a little bit of heat on you. I sold the Sunburn script to Harvey, the Miramax. I sold the Just Friends to New Line. So now I had some heat on me. So I was able to get hired to do some rewrites, a couple of page one things, a couple of punch-ups here or there. And a lot of it was like PG-13 type movies and stuff. So I was feeling like, oh, you know, like I considered myself like an R-rated guy and I'm doing a lot of PG-13 stuff. I kind of wanted to get my edge back. And so I started writing this script, Gardener of Eden. And, you know, it was one of the only times I think I ever started a script without outlining it first. I had ideas, you know, and I just started writing. And, you know, it opens in the bagel store where I used to work, and I put some fun stuff from my time working there, and then this crazy thing happened and blah, blah, blah. And I tell this twisty-turny story, and I'm like literally discovering it as I'm writing it. I finish it up. I send it to my agent, and at first he doesn't even get it. He's like, I don't know what this is. My managers, who are younger...
he definitely didn't say, did you write this about me?
No. No, it was more like, why did you write this at all? But my managers, who were significantly younger, they all really dug it. So then my agent did the coolest thing. He calls me up on Thanksgiving, and we're getting ready. We're cooking. I have family coming over. And my agent calls, and I thought he was just going to say Happy Thanksgiving. Instead, he's like, look, everybody, you know, they all liked it. You like it. So I realized I had read it. I was taking calls. It was during the day. I locked myself in a room and I reread it and I fucking love it. I was like, oh, he goes, yeah, I think you have something really special here. He goes, let me tell you something, though. I don't think studios are going to get it. Some producers might get it, but you know who's going to love it? Actors. Actors who have companies that want to make movies. So I'm going to make a list of actors, and one of the first ones on the list is Leonardo DiCaprio's Appian Way. I think he will respond to it. There's a Scorsese-ness and a Taxi Driver-ness to it a little bit, so I'm going to send it over to them. And sure enough, I get a call. It's DiCaprio's manager, and she's like, okay, I love it. And we gave it to Leo to read. So he's going to be reading it on this day at this time. And I'm like, oh.
Jesus
Christ. Then I get another call. It's like, okay, he's sitting down and reading it. Then I'm getting another call. Like, okay, he's about 10 pages in and he seems to like it. And like, they're literally live vlogging the fucking read to me. Okay, he's 24. Wow. He finished the first act. He gave me a thumbs up. He's halfway done. He's still enjoying it. I'm like, and I'm thinking like, oh, the ending is kind of cool and it is a little surprising. So if he's, you know, if he's gotten this far, he should like it. And then, yeah, I get a call, and it's like, okay, he finished the script. He wants to meet with you. And
Oh, my God.
So the funny thing is, like, the lead character, the way it was originally written, is a big, heavy-set dude who has trouble getting girls. He's kind of a schlubby loser. And, you know, he works in a food store, and everybody makes fun of him and all that. And it's supposed to be a big guy. So what happens is I go to this meeting with Leo. And when I get there, actually, it's kind of funny. It's in a Midtown Manhattan hotel, the kind of place that I would never be allowed in. and he's in like this cocktail bar. You know, it's been emptied out for the most part. I could see him. His back is to me. And I start to, it's a summer day. And, you know, for me, I'm not a small guy. So I wear shorts in the summer. I'm sorry. It is hot. I'm wearing shorts. And I walk in and they grab me and they're like, sorry, sir, no shorts allowed in the cafe. And I'm like, dude, you see that? That's one of the biggest stars in Hollywood who's here to talk to me about my goddamn script. Please do not let 1 foot of fabric stand in the way of my goddamn script of my career, like 1 foot of pant leg. So he's like, okay, hurry, hurry, hurry. And I had to like run over and stick my legs under the table. And, you know, so I meet, you know, DiCaprio's there, his father is there, his manager's there. And we had this beautiful start, you know, this conversation about the script. But I ask him, I say, are you thinking about playing the lead? And he goes, honestly, I think I'm wrong for this. And I go, you know what? As much as I'd love to write a movie for Leonardo DiCaprio, I agree. I go, but you have a friend. And he smiles. I go, Ethan Suplee. And he goes, you're not going to believe this. He goes, but we did a table read of your script. I go, you did? He goes, yeah, me and Tobey Maguire and this one and that one. And Ethan, you know, Ethan Suplee was there. And usually when we finish a table read, everybody goes, oh, Leo, this one's for you. Or Tobey, this one's for you. Instead, everybody goes, Ethan, you're up. And
on the money, right on the money.
And then we like, we're literally hugging. The problem is, Ethan Suplee got hired. We even shot test footage with him and some great shit, but Ethan Suplee got hired to be on the TV show My Name is Earl, and so he couldn't shoot it for months and months and months, and they didn't want to wait, so we had to recast it, and that's when Lucas Haas got cast as the part. And at first I was like thrown a little because Lucas Haas is not a big, heavyset guy. He's
right.
A skinny, kind of normal guy. And I was like, well, Leo was wrong for it, but but Lucas is right somehow. But they're like, well, Lucas is kind of weird and we'll go the other way. He's scrawny and he puts on muscle instead of being big and losing weight and stuff. And I was like, okay, you know, what are you going to do? You got to get the movie made. So, sure. And Lucas is great. Lucas is great in it. Yeah, I wish that movie had, like, you know, it premiered at a film festival. It could have been bought. People made offers. They decided not to sell it, the powers that be. I think they just wanted to take a loss on the money, and that way they could underwrite some other stuff that they had made a lot of money on. And yeah, it kind of got shelved. So I'm glad you saw it, but it's not easy to see.
Well, actually, Adam, I haven't seen it,
well,
and it was such
then.
A shame.
Yeah,
it's
me.
Such a shame because I really want to. It's so hard, at least here in the UK.
Right.
It's so hard to find.
What is your tolerance for Russian pirate sites?
I am easy.
Okay, I will send you a link.
It would be an honor. Thank you, sir. I would love to.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's kind of crushing because it's one of my favorite scripts that I wrote. It got, like, you know, everybody was so into it. I mean, look, the movie, again, you asked, is the movie, you know, the same that I wrote? I mean, it's not in large part, partly because of casting, but more so because of money. Because it was budgeted for, like, you know, it's not a big budget movie, but, like, you know, they had originally budgeted the script I wrote for about $10 to $12 million. Somebody came in and said, I'll give you four. Big producer, I'll give you four. And they said, great, we can use that four to raise the other eight easily. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, that's it. You get my four, no other money's allowed to be put in. That's it. I get full ownership, whatever. So that's the hint to me that there's something going on. And then I had to do a rewrite to literally take $6 to $8 million out of the budget. So that's a weird way to write. Like, I'm not writing to make it better. I'm writing to make it less expensive. Like,
that's interesting.
The scene where they drive motorcycles at night. Bye. No motorcycles. No, you know, no motorcycle insurance and no, you know, having to get motorcycles and people that can ride, you know. Now it's a guy in a car and he doesn't really ride. He just kind of pulls up, you know, stuff like that.
Wow.
You know.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, I had a big fight scene on the train tracks with a train coming. Yeah, that's all gone. Now it's
right.
Fighting somebody in front of somebody's house. We're going to shoot it in 3 hours, you know. So
right. And was it an instance as well where you on set or was this?
Yeah, I was
not
on,
as close.
I was on set. You know, it's funny. You know, like Just Friends was like going to like college away from home because like we were in Canada, we were sequestered, whatever. Garden of Eden was shot in Staten Island. So that was like going to like one of those like, you know, schools where you go for the day and then you don't actually live there. You come home every night. And it was just like show up for a couple hours. I think they were happy I was there. But if I didn't show up, I don't think they would be super disappointed either. I didn't get a cameo in it. You know, but I did enjoy being there, especially when actors had questions. And the director was like, you know what, talk to tech. So I did get to talk to actors and we did work out some stuff. And in some cases they had thoughts and changes. And I was like, all right, let's spitball the scene. And now we're running the scene together. And that was kind of cool, you know. And
that's cool.
We had a great young cast. We had like Jim Parsons before The Big Bang Theory. And so he was like the most accessible guy because he was the only one of the group that wasn't like famous at all. You know, Jerry Ferrara, who became famous from Entourage, he played Turtle. And, you know, Kevin Connolly, who, you know, was on Entourage, of course, and he directed the movie. You know, we had the David Patrick Kelly from the Warriors, come out and play, was the dad.
Yeah.
He's fucking awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And that guy thinks through his character. He was coming up with stuff. And unfortunately, we didn't have the time and the budget to like he's like, I could wear a suit that makes me look like a bush and then I could attack my son and he won't see me because I'll be a bush. And we're like, that is amazing. But who the fuck has time to make a bush suit?
Yeah.
We should keep the steam in an hour, you know?
That's so cool. Yeah. I mean, you've got Giovanni Ribisi, who apparently is turning into a very accomplished cinematographer now in his own right with that new horror film, Strange Darling. I haven't seen it, but I've heard so many great things. Yeah. It's super and a super exciting cast. And I can't wait to check it out.
That was one thing. We got Giovanni. And then it was like, can we write more scenes for that character? And I was like, it's weird to just write extra scenes, but I was like, yeah, why not? You know?
Yeah.
And he's fantastic. He never broke character. He came into set as the character and went home as the character. I've never actually met Giovanni Ribisi.
Right.
I only know Vic the drug dealer. Anyway.
You know Vic. Yeah. Yeah. Well, You've segued from narrative to documentary filmmaking. Was that always an interest of yours? Did something spark that shift? And does it go hand in hand with you being the co-founder of Atomic Entertainment, which is your own production company?
So, I mean, look, I'm interested in all facets of film and filmmaking. I don't have the documentary. The thing I'm good at is like with documentary is like, you know, or like, you know, even like with Brain Games and stuff like that, which is kind of shot a little bit doc style in the sense we're going to do an experiment and see what happens. I'm good at being able to see what I have and then piece a story together out of that. So it's, while it's not the thing I normally gravitate towards, because I like to write things, I like to script them out. With Doc, you shoot stuff and then make the story after. But I do have that skill set from storytelling to be able to say, okay, I've got these pieces and how do I tell a story with them? But it might not be that, you know, that's the journalistic problem where it's like the story might not be as good as it could be. What do you do? Do you make it better or do you just, you know, in Doc, you can't. You're supposed to just, right. It is what it is. So you do the best you can with it. You know, with Brain Games and stuff like that, it was more like, you know, I mean, I make the joke that like my partner, Jerry Kolber from Atomic, you know, he's brains and I'm games, you know, so it's like, you know, so it's like, you know, he comes up with like here's the thing we want to, the topic we want to work on, whether it's focus or anger or emotions or, you know, how your brain responds to certain stimuli or you know, optical illusions or whatever. And then I'm like, okay, how do we make this fun? How do we make this visual? How do we make this fun for an audience? And if I can take science, which is not my strong suit nor my first love, but if I can make that interesting for me, then it's probably going to be interesting for the general public. So that was the way that worked. And yeah, that show did really well for us. We got an Emmy nomination for it, and it really launched our company. And then, you know, working out of that. And now, you know, now that we do a lot of podcasts that are educational for kids. So we have one of the biggest kids educational podcasts called Who Smarted.
Who Smarted, yeah.
And that we started in the pandemic because we couldn't shoot anything. We couldn't leave our house, you know. So it's like we got microphones and I just wrote some stuff and we recorded it and it blew up. You know, we didn't think it was going to last that long. It's the Hanukkah of podcasts because, you know, it was going to last 8 days. It was, you know, last a day or two.
Yeah.
4 years later, it's one of the top podcasts in the world. So, and again, it's just taking topics and making it as fun as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to say as well, so science was my first love, you know, like I went to university and studied physics and I was, you know, I was researching and I was having a look at these podcasts that you've been doing and I can't help but think this kind of edutainment content is something that I wish I had, you know. It's like a really great alternative to the dry curriculum you get at school. So yeah, I think it's really great work that you're doing here.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, that was the same. My wife says the same thing. She was like, oh man, I wish I had this when our kid was little.
Yeah.
But she did have Brain Games. Like, you know, my daughter was on Brain Games. She played, she did an experiment one time and, you know, I didn't tell her anything about it. In fact, she helped shape it because she was so interested in the stuff that I would show her, the little bits of the show, that I was like, oh, I think kids are going to like this. And so, let's not make it so adult, because I was going to write an episode like Sex on the Brain. And I was like, nah, my 8-year-old kid's going to be watching. I don't want to learn about sex from daddy's show. So let's turn it into Attraction, an episode on attraction and why our brains are attracted to similar things. And that became like a guiding point. And then we realized how many kids were watching Brain Games. So then after Brain Games ended for us, that's when we did Brainchild. We're like, let's just go lean in completely and do a kid's version. And we got very lucky because Pharrell Williams walked into our agent's office one day and said, hey, I watched this show Brain Games with my kid. I'd love to do a kid version of that. And they said, well, we happen to rep the Brain Games guys and they want to do a kid's version. So we met with Pharrell and he was like, you guys are geniuses. Tell me what you need from me and let's get this thing going. And so
poof. Look at that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And now, now a lot of podcasting. I got to talk about my Oscars show at some point, but we'll do that in a second.
Please, yeah. No, absolutely. Well, to get back to what we were saying earlier, you mentioned in an email that you have been down a few rabbit holes of late, and you said you had watched 500 film noirs since the pandemic. How's that going? Any standouts?
572 now. I mean, there's the obvious ones. You know, the crime ones, the Casablancas, the William Holden, Hollywood Boulevard. You know, there's those classic ones, Double Indemnity, stuff like that. But then there's just great ones that fly under the radar. In fact, I was just telling my Angel Face. I was just telling my friend to watch this movie Angel Face with Robert Mitchum, and he watched it. He was like, "Why have I not heard about this movie?" You know. you know, out of the...
Did Ennio Morricone score that movie?
Maybe. I think you might be right. Yeah.
Possibly. Because I listened to a song called Angel Face.
Okay.
Countries.
I'd have to Google that. I can't think.
Okay. I'm also not doing Morricone justice.
The problem is trying to keep it all straight in my head, especially the film noirs, because so many of them have very generic titles. You know, there's a great one called Conflict. Like, okay, that's the title. Like, but like Humphrey Bogart's in it, and right. He plays a bad guy. Like, you're not used to seeing that, you know? So it's like, wow, super cool. You know, there's, you know, Double Indemnity is like the big one, but there was another one with Kim Novak called Pushover, which I think is just as good, if not better. And it's got Fred McMurray playing like this conflicted cop who is in love with her, but is helping her cover up a thing and get money and stuff. And he has to, as a cop, he's playing both sides. It's fucking brilliant. The Big Clock is another one. I freaking loved it. You know, and it stars, the same guy from DOA, but I thought Big Clock was better, you know? So it's like, you know, DOA gets all the attention, but Big Clock, I thought was great. But yeah.
Okay, you might have to steer me onto some of these. You can send me like a mini list of your standard, because we haven't seen any of these.
Right. Okay. No, it's great. I look, that's the thing. I'm a list guy. During the pandemic, the first list I did was I said Alfred Hitchcock. Okay. I found a thing. There's a site online. You know, it's called List Challenges, and you could literally type anything into List Challenges, and it comes up with a list, and you can click off the ones you've done.
I'm making a note of that right now.
So for me, I put in like films of Alfred Hitchcock, and I start clicking off the ones I've seen. And I saw like 24 movies by Alfred Hitchcock. And I was like, oh, that's pretty good, right? 24 movies by one director. Then I realized he has 57 movies. I hadn't even seen half the fucking movies. So
yeah.
I was like, oh my God. Now, Greg, there's about 13 or so that are like silent movies. And there's a batch that he made when he was just a sort of for hire director. So he hadn't really become his Hitchcockiness. You know, he wasn't that guy.
Sure.
But then once he becomes that, great. And then I got to see all these movies that I hadn't really seen or, you know, not among the ones that everybody talks about, and like Shadow of a Doubt and Notorious and Spellbound, The Paradine Case, you know. Now, granted, not all of them are good, but there's one called like Jamaica Inn about pirates. And it's got Charles Laughton in it. It's awesome. It's awesome. Yeah. I loved it. So, it's so good. So that was the first of the list. And then I went back to List Challenges. Now I'm looking up other directors. I'm looking up genres. My friend and I, we got into film noir, and I just started gobbling up film noirs. And the best part about them, hour long, hour and 10, hour and 20. You can watch.
Easily digestible.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You can watch three film noirs for one brutalist.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or even four. Yeah, I don't know if you've seen or heard of it, but Steven Zalian, you know, brilliant writer and director. He recently wrote and directed a miniseries called Ripley, which is on Netflix.
Yes,
which is the remake of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Adam, I mean, if you like film noir, and it's starring Andrew Scott, watch that. I think it's 8-9 episodes. Yes. Shot for shot, the black and white photography, the directing, the cinematography. I mean, it is so sumptuous and mesmerizing. It's gorgeous.
Right.
I know it's a very modern iteration of film noir, but I mean, I think you might love this.
Oh, see, the problem with me is I'm such a movie guy that I don't start a lot of series. So people are always like, have you seen this series? But I do like close-ended series. That I'm fine with. And I did hear about this. I have it on my list of things to check out.
Nice.
I will say this. If you're a writer, you have to watch film noir, because the writing is so stellar in so many of them. It's so sharp. These actors are great, delivering these great lines. not a lot of stuff happens in terms of like there's no CGI, there's no big effects scenes and stuff. In fact, when they try to do stuff, usually it looks pretty cheesy. The car chases and you could see it's fake and all that. So screw whatever, put that aside. They throw that in there, you know, some action or whatever, but the dialogue and the plotting and and I go into these movies knowing nothing except the title. I don't care. Like, I just, what's the next one on the list? I'm going to watch that. Oh, it's got Joan Crawford in it. Great. She's like, her movies are always better than the other ones. You know, what's her name? Barbara Stanwyck. Always good. Always delivers a great performance. You know, and then you find these luminaries of the genre. And yeah, the writing though is so sharp. I am working on a movie idea where a film noir detective from like the 40s or 50s is chases somebody into like a time travel thing and winds up in today's time and is still still trying to be a film noir detective, slapping people, smoking cigarettes in the hospital, you know, like just being an asshole. And it's like, no, we don't do that, sir. Like, there's stuff in those movies that like you can't believe the way they slap women around. Like, it's crazy.
You could pay such homage to the genre with something like that. Yeah.
That is a comedy concept that I'm working on. But yeah, I love the film noir. And then, yeah, I got into other, you know, lists of other genres, Westerns. I got my horror list. I got my video nasties list. I found this 1,000 best movies, whatever. Somebody put together this thing. And I'm like, all right, let's check it off. How many have I seen? 482. Okay, great. Let's finish the list. I'm up to 700 and something on that. A lot of foreign movies that I hadn't really seen. I love that you've got a Solaris poster behind you.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a great movie.
Luke is a Tarkovsky man.
I am a Tarkovsky fan. Yeah. I've got another poster for The Mirror just on the other wall here. But
did you see Andrei Rublev?
Not yet. That's one I've got to like set a block aside for, because it's a bit it's quite a chunky film, isn't it?
Yes, and it's hard to understand, and there's a lot of people in it that look similar. So here's what I did. I opened up Wikipedia, put the movie, and it's told in chapters. So what you do is you watch the movie, watch a chapter, then go and read the Wikipedia on that chapter, and it helps fill in the gaps that you might have. And then you watch the next chapter, go back, do the Wikipedia, and you'll understand the movie a little. Because it was like one guy, I was like, is that the same guy as before? It's like, no, it's his brother. But he looks just like, and I was like, if I didn't know that, like I would be completely lost.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's
good to know.
Interesting.
Yeah, good to know. Because weirdly, I did have the same issue when I watched The Mirror as well. Because like all the actors look the same.
Yeah, so. Mirror's tough. Yeah. I mean, I Stalker is great, but I don't think I love it as much as some of the other ones. So anyway.
You would be great in our film club. We've been a part of a film club since the pandemic, and we go around once a week. We pick movies, and any decade, any genre, you would be very interesting on a go around. You mentioned it in your email as well. You a fun thing of watching all horror movies that start with the word "don't." How's that going?
If you're thinking of doing it, don't. Most of them suck.
Oh, okay.
Most of them suck. I mean, they are just bad. I did see one Italian one that was pretty good. It's called Don't Torture a Duckling. That one's pretty good. I have to say, that one is good.
What a title.
But most of them are terrible. Don't answer the phone. Don't go in the woods. Don't, what is it, the other one that was, don't go in the park or don't go near the park. You know, yeah, so many of them are just so bad. But I think I have three more left. I just found one. It's something about Christmas or whatever. Don't something on Christmas, or don't open till Christmas. I was like, what is this? I never even heard of it. It's like, shit.
I love it.
I'm sure it's going to suck.
Yeah. Did you ever see Don't Breathe?
Of course. That was a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm conscious that we're getting on here. I guess I'll close up, Adam, by asking you, what's next for you? Any projects on the horizon? I know you mentioned this film noir idea, but you also mentioned another podcast, I think.
Yes. Yeah, so the thing, the big thing is like, you know, so we're spinning off our Atomic Entertainment. We're going to just literally start an Atomic Audio. And, you know, we're having a lot of success with podcasts. We really like it because we get to control it. We own it. It's ours. I'm not getting notes from a studio and executives and a network. And I don't have to wait for anybody. They're cheap and easy to spin up. So right now I've got about four or five podcasts going. And the one that we just started that's probably most interest to you guys and to your audience is I have a podcast called The Oscars. What Were They Thinking? Where we look back at the Oscars of the past using, you know, the test of time to sort of see and debate what they got right, what they got wrong, the flubs, the snubs, the oversights, that kind of thing. And look, again, it's not like the, you know, it's not like, oh, this one should have won over that one. Like, whatever. The what won, what, you know, it's not baseball. They didn't score a couple of runs and win the Oscars. No, it's all subjective. I totally get that. But there are some weird anomalies, weird things that, like, movies that have not stood the test of time that have won, movies that have stood the test of time that weren't even nominated their year. And the year that got me started in this thinking was, I don't know, I was just goofing around. I guess I had seen a movie from, like, 1960 and was wondered if it had, you know, been nominated or if it had gotten any acclaim. And I'm looking at the 1961 Oscars for the films of 1960, and I see that The Apartment – The Billy Wilder movie with Jack Lemmon, that won the Oscar. And I'm like, great. Yeah, that's a fantastic movie. I see the other movie that's nominated, the big movie that from that year that was nominated was Elmer Gantry with Burt Lancaster. Also a phenomenal movie. Burt Lancaster is great in it. He actually wins the Oscar for Best Actor. But then I look at the other three movies that were nominated, and you got something called Sons and Lovers. You got one called The Sundowners, and you've got one called it's John Wayne in The Alamo. And I'm like, okay, I don't know two of those movies. John Wayne, Alamo, I wouldn't put that in the pantheon of great films. So maybe it was not a great year for movies that year. Except I start looking at other nominees. And for the directing category, Alfred Hitchcock is nominated for a little movie called Psycho. And I'm like, wait, Psycho came out that year? Not even nominated. And then Peter Ustinov wins a Best Supporting Actor for a little movie called Spartacus. And I'm like, wait, Spartacus came out that year? Also, not nominated, not any, you know, nothing. And so I'm like, okay, I think there's a show where we look back at the Oscars and we just pick out all the anomalies. But I knew that, A, I'm not enough of a draw. And also, I needed a real Oscar, you know, fanatic and aficionado. And so I got Bruce Valanche, who is like, he wrote for the Oscars for 25 years. I don't know if you know, he might be before your time, but like he was on TV all the time. He was in the Hollywood squares. He's a interesting looking guy. If you look up Valanche, V-I-L-A-N-C-H, you might know him. He's written and acted, and he's like a personality, you know, and he is a historian. His memory is insane. He was there for 25 years. He wrote the Oscars more than anybody alive and wrote all the, you know, host stuff for Billy Crystal and Steve Martin and Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg. He knows everybody. And so he's an amazing resource. He's seen all these movies. And then so the show is called The Oscars, What Were They Thinking? So for me, it's like, what were they thinking? And for him, he's like, no, here's what they were thinking. Here's why.
Excellent.
Yeah, here's why they didn't get nominated. Here's why Citizen Kane didn't win the Oscar, even though everybody knows it's the greatest film of all time. Didn't win the Oscar the year it came out, which is crazy.
Okay, this sounds very exciting. I'm looking at Bruce Valanche's just his writing credits on IMDb, and it is mostly nothing but Oscars, Oscars, Oscars. That's amazing.
Oscars,
that's
in terms of the show, the stuff he's actually written, there's a lot of garbage. but he knows that, and he has a book coming out that's called It Was a Bad Idea at the Time. So he's written some of the most craptastic stuff ever. Like, but he's usually a hired gun. He's brought in. He's funny. He's a joke machine. He's a comedy legend. So I do the show with him, and he is just he is gold. And I just try to keep up with him, and we have a good time. We debate. We fight. And that's the other thing too, because he defends the Academy, and I attack. And so
right,
it's a good yin yang. So it's fun. And sometimes I even get him to change his mind. Sometimes I'm like, he's like, has to admit that maybe Back to the Future was the best movie that year.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Amazing. Yeah. Will you go all the way up to something like the Green Book win?
Well, I you know, the idea is, yeah, well, it depends on the year. Like, to me, it's like, the joke I make is like, we shouldn't be doing the Oscars at the end of the year for the previous year. We should wait 5-10 years,
sure,
like the Hall of Fame for baseball, and like, let's settle the dust and then look back and decide, is this movie,
understood,
yeah, which movie is, you know, is actually meaningful. I mean, you know, we're going to do a nominees episode, you know, when the nominations come out for this year.
Sure.
But I'm like, my thought is like, okay, which of these movies is going to matter in 10 years? Who, what are we, yeah, what are we going to be thinking about, talking about? You know, will anybody give a shit about Anora? I don't know. You know, will anybody be giving a shit,
yeah,
about...
Yeah, I hope so.
I hope so.
Yeah. I do too. Sean Baker is a good filmmaker. He was in my class at NYU. Great guy.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, sweetheart. Great filmmaker.
Well, that's amazing. Honestly, I cannot wait. I will be listening to that because that's right up my alley. That's my shit right there.
Fantastic.
Adam, a huge thank you for coming on here and giving us your time and talking to us. It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Yeah, it's been
great.
Thank you.
Guys are awesome.
Yeah,
you guys are awesome.
I wish you all the best going forward. We will be diligently following your work and cheering you on.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm still writing. I'm still, you know, still writing scripts and stuff. I mean, yeah, busy. I got a lot of stuff going on. But, yeah, my screenwriting has always been first love. So, all you writers out there, write. You know, there's nothing can stop
absolutely
you. Nothing can stop you from writing. They can stop every other thing.
Right.
They can't stop you from writing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. And, hey, if you ever need an ethnically ambiguous-looking actor from the UK, a skinhead, I'm your man.
You got it. You got a great
thank
voice. I could also
much,
maybe
so
use you on the podcast to do some voices.
It would be my pleasure. It would be my absolute pleasure.
You got it.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. A special thanks once again to Adam Tex Davis and, of course, Phoenix Cinema. Our music is by Stefan Krieger. You can find more of his music on stefan-krieger.com. And our episodes are edited by Noah Anderson. If you like what you're hearing, spread the word far and wide. Like, rate, and subscribe. And then after you've done that, go and watch a movie at the Phoenix Cinema, and I'll see you there.